Good afternoon. Thank you for listening to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. This is your host, Dr. John Pinero. Our guest today is someone I had the good fortune to hear deliver a lecture a few months ago at the Russell Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal up in Mecosta, Michigan, and it's Dr. James Patrick. Dr. James Patrick is the senior fellow at the Walsingham Society of Christian Culture and Western Civilization. And he writes on a variety of things and also writes some wonderful meditations on the Sunday Gospels that some of you and I receive an email each week. But today what we're going to be talking about is an essay he's written, and I believe he's delivered this in lecture many times, about the barbarians. We've all heard this term, barbarian. Maybe it conjures up people without manners and without behavior. Maybe it conjures up images of pillaging and the sacking of cities. For all I know, maybe it just makes you think of Conan the Barbarian. But what we're going to do today is talk about a very different kind of barbarian once we're through with those who gave the name barbarian to barbarian, and that is the Goths and the Vandals and those folks who sacked Rome and changed Roman civilization, but also, I think, and we'll talk about this with Dr. Patrick, had some things to offer Roman civilization in a way that perhaps our contemporary barbarians do not. But maybe that's up for debate and up for discussion. So at this point, I'd like to welcome you, Dr. James Patrick, to the program. Welcome to Faith and Reason.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Dr. John. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome. I thought our listeners, before we get into our main topic today, might like to hear a little bit about the Walsingham Society. I only recently learned the history of the devotion to Our Lady of Walsingham, and I was surprised about the very, very long suppression of that. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about why the name Walsingham Society, but also what you do.
I think the name Walsingham Society was really an inheritance from the College of St. Thomas More, which was a college that I was president of for 30 years, institute at first, and then the College of St. Thomas More. And it had a curriculum that was really based on a kind of an Oxford model. And Thomas More was, of course, the patron. And when one thinks of Thomas More in England in the 16th century, the great center of devotion there was the devotion to Our Lady of Walsingham up in East Anglia. A devotion which was very, very popular. Everybody went, even Henry VIII went to Walsingham. And then, of course, the shrine was suppressed by Henry VIII in the 1530s. And then in the late 19th century, it was brought back, first of all, by a very pious Anglican lady who found one of the original Walsingham buildings, a little building called now the Slipper Chapel, a little 15th century Gothic building which had been built into a barn and consequently preserved. She became a Catholic and wound up in the possession of the diocese and then was made in the 1930s. It became the English National Shrine of Our Lady. And it's a wonderful place to visit and to go to when you're in England up in East Anglia and say your prayers and ask Our Lady for her help there. So that's what Our Lady of Walsingham is, and that's why we're always attached to Our Lady of Walsingham.
So is there a sense in some way then that the Walsingham Society is clearly to preserve or restore what's been best about Western civilization and particularly Christian culture?
You're in a situation in which what's needed is keeping things alive, because it's not a great time for the obvious aspects of Western civilization or for civilization as it is related to the Catholic Church. And so it's good for there to be places that represent what that civilization is in a culture to which it's now somewhat tangential.
I like to think of our culture in this way, but I do think of it in this way. I mean, we're very much in a post-Christian culture, and I think many people recognize that. We're not in a period of, I mean, I think the decline in some way is over. So So the question remains for the faithful what to do about it, and that's why we're very happy to have you on our program today. The title of your essay that I've read, and I'd like to talk about that and anything else that occurs to you along the way that you could help us out with today, is Remembering 410, as in the year 410, What to Do When the Barbarians Possess the Streets. And the fall and decline of Rome is something that I, as a history student, and studied quite a bit in college. Ancient Mediterranean was one of my subfields at the master's level, and we talked a lot about decline versus transformation. That is what really happened to Roman civilization, what was left behind, what was merely transformed, what was transformed by Christianity, but what was just transformed generally. But 410 was this a key year in the history of Roman civilization. Why draw such a comparison between the folks we'll talk about later, today's barbarians, and these barbarians like the Goths who entered Rome in 410 and spent many days sacking the city?
Well, you can pick various dates, as I'm sure you know. The barbarian invasions had begun earlier than 410. I think one date commonly cited is about 346, but the 410 was the first time that the city of Rome had been entered by alien troops since about 390 B.C., and that's one of the reasons that it unhinged everybody so decisively, was because this wasn't supposed to happen, and all of a sudden then there they were. And of course, these people who came in 410 were not the worst that could have happened, because they were Arian Christians, and they didn't destroy all the churches, but they were barbarians. Interestingly enough, they were ambiguous about what they wanted to do. They wanted to take possession of things, but they also had a certain admiration for Roman civilization, kind of wanted to move in. And they're a way in which, in addition to being our enemies, they're sort of our ancestors, because they are the Germans who moved into the Roman Empire. And as you say, the empire was not utterly destroyed. You can make the case that there's at least an empire of ideas that goes all the way back to Homer that really was not over in a kind of visible sense until perhaps the early 19th century, but 410 was one of the great transitions in it. And I chose that because our civilization has undergone a great transition. You know, I can remember being very grown up now, but the world into which I came was a very different world than the one I live in now in terms of its presuppositions. The presupposition, at least in the American South, was that Christianity was just sort of what people did. And granted, it was weak in a way, but it was pervasive, and it influenced the civilization, and it made it easier to try to be a good person. I always like to point out to my students at the college that how difficult it was to be really bad in 1945, because if you tried to be bad at the drugstore, the druggist would call your father. If you tried bad at the movie theater, the manager would call your father. Whereas now you're just kind of out there by yourself. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this was because I wanted to encourage people to realize, as you said, that because the things that we depend on as cultural signs are not evident anymore, it doesn't mean that Christianity is over. It does mean that we don't have the pleasure of that kind of triumphalist sort of reinforcement that we always would like to have a little salting of in order to reassure us, and so that we have to kind of go on with courage into the situation that is. But I thought that that one of the things that would help would be to kind of clear up a little of the ambiguity. You mentioned the fact that we know that we're in a post-Christian era. I'm not entirely sure that we all know that, or that's widely held, because if that were widely held, I don't think there would be this kind of pining for the restoration of Christian civilization, which we all sort of have in a way. but which is not the most appropriate thing to do. So it seemed to me, if I could point out that, not indeed as the first person, but as one of many people who pointed out that really things have happened that it's going to take a long time to get back past, that really mean that we live in kind of a different world, and that to know that, I had thought was kind of freeing in a way, and so that was why I gave my kind of list of things that I considered decisive turning points. Now, other people would give a different list of decisive turning points. I just thought that those were the defensible ones that really kind of meant something to me. So,
what struck me, we'll talk about them now. What struck me about your list is that these turning points were not, well, one of them, I guess, could be classified as somewhat political, but they mostly have to do with literature, with art, with beauty, and with changes in the way we perceive those things, those kinds of signs and symbols that that do make it, they do make it easier to live as a Christian in a society when you have the surrounding culture contributing, you hope, towards your salvation rather than fighting against it. I can imagine that in any age is going to have its particular challenges towards living the gospel and towards our individual conversion in Christ. But the modern world does seem to have quite a few unprecedented ones, or maybe they're the same old ones, but just ramped up quite a bit. I'm not quite sure what I think of that at the moment, but in any case, even back in the Roman Empire, then you mentioned that there's a lot of things that the Romans did to try to survive and to try to keep what they thought was best about their civilization. So at a time when some Romans were saying, look, we're in this predicament because of Christianity sapping our civilization, the Christians were saying, well, we're in this predicament because we're not a Christian enough civilization. What are your thoughts on that, at least the way the Romans responded? Because I think there's a lot we can learn from the response that gave birth to everything from the Benedictine monasteries to eventually Charlemagne's empire.
Well, it's a fascinating period because, of course, Christian civilization just sort of resolutely refused to die, although it had had very difficult centuries there in the late 5th, 6th, 7th centuries, and there are various assessments of what that was. It was really a time in many ways of very great creativity. You can argue a little bit about exactly when the Dark Ages were, if there were any genuinely Dark Ages. More and more tend to think that perhaps they were not so dark, but the period from 410 down to Charlemagne is really a fascinating period, and it's the period out of which everything that followed came. And if it didn't have a lot of good things in it, then you would have to somehow explain the monasteries. You'd have to explain Charlemagne. You'd have to explain Alfred of Wessex. You'd have lots of... you'd have to explain that burning desire to keep memory alive and all the copying and preserving of manuscripts and the kind of tendency, I think I mentioned maybe Vincent of Lerins, to want to remember so that these things would not be lost. So it's not just a period of unmoderated disaster. It's a period of great trial in which a lot of things that probably needed to go went. One of the things that went was, of course, the conviction that God intended the Roman Empire to be the expression of his will into some indefinite future. This would be controversial, but I think I said in the article that it seemed to me that one of the things that happened to Christianity in the 4th century was that it moved into the place that had been held by the old religion, in the sense that to some degree its purpose was to keep the empire safe, make the legions victorious, preserve the borders, make the empire secure, and then it turned out that it was not God's will that empire was going to be permanently secure, because God had used it for his purposes, and then something else was coming along. So I thought it was that was an interesting kind of situation.
Yeah, I think, you know, in one of Paul's letters, Galatians maybe, he talks about Jesus coming in the fullness of time. And this was something St. Augustine commented on in the City of God. That is that, as Christopher Dawson also explains, Christians were able to figure out by the time period we're talking about here, when Augustine was alive during that sack in 410, if Rome came to an end, it might be the end of an age, but not the end of the world. That is, the end of the world could come at a later date. So what does this mean now? And you can imagine if there had not been any invasions for 800 years, they don't call it the Eternal City for no reason, right? And
right.
I mean, how psychologically shocking, even of course to the Christians, they must have had to deal with this too.
Well, exactly. This was not something that any of them welcomed. I cited in the article St. Augustine, who, you know, viewed the Roman Empire as an instrument of God's promise, and he viewed its demise with regret and hoped that this was not the end because he wanted it to go on, which is kind of a noble thing to do. It's not a fine thing to say, I'm glad the barbarians are coming to get rid of all this wickedness, because although that will happen, there were other ways to get rid of wickedness that God might have chosen, but he just chose this to bring something new about. Of course, the Roman Empire had run through all of the kinds of things that we run through, which you'll be aware is just common to empires. They had not been able to maintain the borders in the long run. They had debased the currency. I always like to point out that in the end, they had begun to take political advice from gladiators and actresses.
We're still talking about Rome?
Right.
Okay.
So it's not in a way that unusual. Now, this particular situation, you know, if you look at the way the intellectual history of the West has been interpreted, there are whole lots of people who believe, and I would probably be one of them, that this is somewhat different than your characteristic cultural collapse, because what it did was unhinge sort of the basic presuppositions of the civilization. C.S. Lewis and his friends had a topic that they simply called it the break, and they would want to consider when the break happened. You know, and you can date the break from, well, you can begin with William of Ockham in the 14th century, or you can date it from the Renaissance, or you can date it from the Industrial Revolution. It seems to me that you can make a case for all of those, even for something as remote as William of Ockham, but at the time when the whole thing became sort of endemic, when things kind of came together in this great sort of crescendo of things that attack the foundations of our civilization, it would have been the very early 19th century would have been a good time at least to look at, which is why I chose those things and not some other things.
Okay, sure. Well, I mean, we have to find some place to start. So why the early 19th century then? I think of the early 19th century, I guess I think of the Napoleonic Wars, the tail end of the Enlightenment, but also a very dynamic period for the growth of the United States in terms of my own country. Why the early 19th century?
I'm sorry, I misspoke. Like I could, one of the times we could pick is that really is critical is the 1830s, which is early 19th century. Mm-hmm. In the article, I should have said early 20th century.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The things that I picked were really early 20th century. I shouldn't have said 19th century.
Okay, no, I guess so. Early 1900s. Well, then, maybe World War One. Then that's the big demarcation line, I guess.
Was really kind of the end, wasn't it? I mean, we've never. It was the beginning of a war that, in a certain sense, has never ceased, and it represented the coming together of the technological ability that you had first kind of experienced in maybe the Crimean War or the American War of 1860 that just created generalized slaughter and was so dispiriting and just really, really destroyed a lot of Western Europe. And it left a kind of moral sort of a vacuum. It's the period after which it was so hard to say beauty and so hard to say courage, and those things seem to be somehow hollow in the aftermath of all that. And you had one of the things you might read on this someday is there's a wonderful essay by C.S. Lewis called De Descriptione Temporum, in which he lists the things that he thought represented this kind of break. And of course, one of them was the de-Christianizing of everything, which came to a kind of head in the early 20th century when Europe sort of de-Christianized itself, when France ceased to be a Catholic country, when Italy, in effect, became a secular republic, when the educational system in the United States, you know, as foreseen by people like Horace Mann, became dedicated to creating a kind of secular human being. All those things were going on in the early 20th century, and we never really have been able to undo them. The foundation of the ACLU goes back to right after this period. But making godless, the popularity of godlessness really sort of dates to this period.
Is World War One then the fruit of this? Is that what you're arguing in some way? I mean, I know mankind has had wars before, but the scale of the slaughter and then the fallout from it in terms of the 20th century nihilism and now a lack of belief in progress or goodness, is that how you draw the connections?
Well, you know, there are people who would say that it represented the collapse of the progressive illusion, because although there were some ups and downs, the Victorian age, sort of stoked and fired by what's sometimes called the Whig theory of history, had really believed that things were progressing so nicely. The British, who are at least in this period, are kind of the characteristic great culture, had a since the Napoleonic Wars, which you mentioned, had only that little involvement in the Crimean War until the Boer War in 1898 to 1902 or 1903. So they had this almost a century of peace and industrial growth and increasing prosperity. And the general conviction was that this would sort of go on forever. And then suddenly it just hit the wall. And we've never been able to, you know, progressive politics has tried to resurrect that sort of view of things. But if you ask the American people whether the country's going in the right direction or not, more than half of us will always say, no, it's not. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think you would have gotten that in 1910.
I see. I think of World War One as one of many examples of moral progress being unable to match the technological progress, and that just seems to speed up over the course of the 20th century till we get to where we are now with our new technologies, which would include access to each other, but to pornography, you name it, and people's ability to resist the temptation to do everything from look at that pornography to text while they're driving. I mean, just all kinds of selfish activities that they find it very difficult. And I mean, I think we see it in the education system as well, where at least in the college I teach, and in all colleges really, especially small colleges, there's this increasing emphasis on having online courses and massive open online courses in the small liberal arts classroom where we sit around and talk about humane things is always in danger of being pushed aside by, I guess today it's okay to call them barbarians.
Oh, it is okay, and you're exactly right. Now, that's a whole other, that's something I didn't go to directly in this essay, but which is sort of the generic catastrophe that's associated with all this is the increasing kind of technological transcendence in the hands of ordinary human beings, all overlaid on the notion that there is progress in things human, which happens not to be true. Just as you said, it is not the case that human nature that you're dealing with now is exactly the human nature that started the war over a girl in Troy. It's exactly the human nature that started World War One. It's the human nature that destroyed the Catholic Church in England. It doesn't change. But taking the analogy from the cell phone, as you said, every year the cell phone is supposedly better. Why are my colleagues not better? We're just the same people attempting to develop some kind of virtue in the midst of the muddle that is the human situation. But everything about the technological model, the enchantment of technology, convinces us that we're moving on toward, well, what, as you say. One of the things I like to point out is that the command over nature and over technology we have would be wonderful if it were in the hands of a race who had kind of connatural restraint and prudence. And since we don't have connatural restraint and prudence, what it does is create chaos.
Right. Well, this is Dr. John Pinheiro, and I'm interviewing Dr. James Patrick, Senior Fellow with the Walsingham Society, and we are talking about modern barbarism and threats to the faith and to truth, goodness, and beauty, and to good living. And we're still talking about the early 20th century here. Why don't we turn now and talk about some more examples here? We mentioned World War One, but there's also you talk about in your essay on this barbarism. You also talk about a transition in the way people viewed art in general. I heard a priest friend of mine, Father Rob Johansson, say at a lecture a little while ago that there's no such thing as ugly art. And what his point was is that all art has to be beautiful to be defined as art. His point wasn't that ugliness can be art, or even that a soup can be art. But you date this to this time period, again, in the first couple decades of the early 20th century. What was going on that revolutionized the way people see or sensed reality and the purpose of art?
Well, I had more kind of controversy about this point than anything else in the essay. One of the things I was not saying is that contemporary art, the kind of thing that the Museum of Modern Art is buying even as we speak, is not art. Because there's more than one definition of art, and a great deal of what we call modern art is full of insight, and I think I can tell, even when it's ugly and I don't like it very much, whether it's art or not, at least some of the time. The point I was trying to make is that the world outside the human psyche ceased to be a subject of interest. And that's something that you ought to be able to see around you day by day at present, is a world in which the younger you are, the more likely you are to be captive to your own psychology, the metaphor for which is that you have your headphones on all the time and your cell phone in hand, and you're moving through a world that you don't see and which you have no essential engagement with. My only point about art in the essay was that down to one day in May in 1917 or 18 or 20, artists thought it was their business to depict the world outside themselves. Now there are now you can go to church fairs and find amateur paintings of barns in the country and flowers and those things, and sometimes they can be quite charming, but great art or the great artists cease to devote themselves to a world outside the self and started painting something else. And it was essentially a kind of art which was full of messages about where we are and who we are, which was not so much about making something, which is what art had classically been, but about telling you something. You know, you can always go back to Eliot, for whom I'm absolutely devoted. He's a wonderful poet, but what he did was sort of tell us who we are in the wasteland. And my only point is that that's not what art had been. It's not the Kent altarpiece. It's not the Madonna of Bruges, which has been in the movies lately. It's not anything that represents beauty out there. It's all about what's inside us, and I think that's very different. I don't think anybody in the Renaissance or in the Enlightenment or in the early, the Impressionists, people like Van Gogh, Renoir, would have been somewhat confused by post-impressionistic art, which is just about something going on inside oneself. It's the woman with one eye. You know, it's things that are not. It's the way we see things. The world doesn't tell us anything. We tell the world a lot, and that's very modern, I think.
And we've all been to, or I have here in Grand Rapids, where we have an annual art exhibition, indoor, outdoor, really a wonderful thing called Art Prize, the biggest art prize contest in the world. And it just attracts tens of thousands of people into downtown Grand Rapids. But I'm always struck by art pieces that require a paragraph, if not an essay, to tell me about the art piece, and are also accompanied by a paragraph or essay that tell me about the artist and how they were feeling and why they do what they do. And, you know, without knowing all that about the artist, I couldn't make heads or tails of the so-called art. And I don't think I don't think I'm a Philistine, but if it takes you two essays to figure it out, maybe it's not really communicating something that the human person naturally grabs hold of.
Exactly, and you're not a Philistine. It's just I'm not particularly interested in knowing that. I don't particularly care what the artist was feeling that day, and artists generally, before the great exhibits that I mentioned in this little essay, would have found that unintelligible, that we would be interested in that. But you know, I'm kind of insistent on this point because I had such a hard time defending it. I'm not arguing that the things at the art show are not art. I'm just arguing that they're very, very different. And to refer again to what Mr. Lewis's essay, De Descriptione Temporum, one of the things he cited was a kind of loss of meaning because there had been a symposium, I guess it was at Oxford, that spent some days or a day or two discussing a 29-line poem of Eliot's called The Cookie Egg, and he pointed out that at the end of it, nobody claimed to know what it meant. And how different this was, you see, it wouldn't have been the case even in 1850, and granting that 1850 is full of sometimes sentimental, not-so-splendid art, but it would have been the case that people said, we don't know what this is. But now, as you say, you go to these things, and they're intriguing, but you're always asking, what are they? And they're just kind of an icon of a culture that has dispensed with reality. You know, St. Thomas always said what you do is you begin by engaging the world out there, which is more than yourself. It's kind of hard now for us to find something that is more than the self we live with.
So if art was undergoing this change in the early 20th century, that is, art being unable to communicate beauty to us, or art communicating only what's inside a person, kind of a self-indulgent art, or as you put in your essay and talking about some of the purposeful meaningless look, what does that tomato soup can mean? It's just a tomato soup can. That's it. And now, there was something else happening, though, you say, with public intellectuals, that is, with the thinkers and the philosophers and that small group of people who, over the centuries, have spent their leisure time thinking about the very, very big questions, the unchanging questions, those questions that humans have always asked since the time of the Greeks. But we see a change there, too, don't we, in terms of their willingness to think that there's actually answers to their questions beyond the answer that there is no answer.
Well, you know, exactly right. The end of it is, the philosophers like Richard Rorty in metaphysics or anti-metaphysics and Peter Singer in ethics, their purpose being, on the one hand, to tell you that nothing can be known, except that, you know, people like Rorty will insist that the assertion that nothing can be known is too positive. And that, and Singer's conviction that the death just may be a good thing. But yeah, this has this again is the end of something, and it is the end of a philosophy called, and there'll be people listening to this who will say, well, this is too much, but it's the end of logical positivism, something in the early 20th century called realism, then logical positivism, analytic philosophy. Not that that doesn't do something, but what it doesn't do is anything that's truly important. It's kind of nugatory. I think I quoted in the article, Collingwood, reflecting on the fact that all of a sudden at Oxford, about the time of the First World War, the conviction that the purpose of philosophy was to lead people to at least contemplate the questions that led to truth and goodness just went away. And that's because the idea that the intellect can reach out there and know the truth went away, and that has just an incredibly long history. It's the death of the first intellectual virtue. You know, there are five intellectual virtues, and the first one of those is insight, which enables you to reach out there and grasp the very forms and things. It's not an empirical activity, it's just something your intellect can do. If the only things you can know are things you can touch or kick or feel, then the positivists are right. But then you get into the question, if that's true, you know, exactly how am I different from my cat? Because both of us are always looking for dinner, and that's about it.
And Singer says you aren't different than your cat, except that maybe the cat's more important than you are.
Maybe the cat's more important than you are. That's right. Yeah, so this is just a bunch of foolishness. And one of the reasons I wrote the essay is I would like for people not to be, you know, not to encourage philistinism and not to encourage not paying attention to these kinds of insights.
Or anti-intellectualism. I don't want to encourage that either.
No, but you don't want to be bullied by these folks. Particularly in the light of the great tradition. You see, one of the things you always want to look at when somebody says nothing can be known is you want to look at the history of that. Throughout the world, have great minds always said nothing can be known? Or is this kind of a new thing that perhaps you could look at and say, where did this come from? And maybe it would be good to pay attention to Plato and Aristotle and St. Augustine and St. Thomas and not leap to the conclusion that, by George, nothing can be known. And although, you know, one of the things about the nothing can be known philosophy is it has advantages. And the advantage is, if something can be known, around the next curve in the stair, there's going to be a moral question to which you're going to have to give an answer. And if nothing can be known, then you're free to give whatever answer comes to mind. So there is a kind of demonic benefit in the philosophy that nothing could be known.
And ultimately, desire or utility fills that gap, I think.
Well, when there are no forms and things, will takes over. Desire takes over. And then you're back to Peter Singer. Yeah, we really are all indistinguishable from our cat. The great tradition lifts up the human heart to things that are true and good. And that's the thing that the Catholic Church does not directly do this, but it's a context in which it's nourished. There has to be an intellectual tradition that does that. And the intellectual tradition, as you mentioned about the college in which you teach, has just kind of collapsed. And one of the reasons it's collapsed is a kind of ignorance that would make the 5th and 6th centuries kind of ashamed, because if you ask students from these places what they know, they don't have any resources for having a good life. You know, all they've done is read a bunch of, you know, their literary formation is The Catcher in the Rye, and their philosophic formation is the You Can Know Nothing philosophy. And so they're kind of helpless. And one of the things that learning education needs to do is give them resources to try to become good people, to have the courage and imagination to build a good life in what's essentially a barbarian world. So anybody that can help with that has my vote.
Well, you talk about education, and it makes me think that the people we're talking about, at least in the early 20th century, we're talking about a time period, I think, where maybe it's 10 to 15% in America, at least, of American males are going to college. And it's a much larger number now, many of whom go to traditional liberal arts colleges but don't necessarily get a liberal arts education that small percentage used to receive. And I'm wondering, what about then the – I don't know if we could use terms like the common person, the average person. How does this trickle down to everyday life, into the people who, you know, Chesterton would have admired them for their common sense in the face of the nobility who sometimes had not met an innovation they didn't like? And Chesterton always thought, or seemed to think, that the elites were much more given to fads than the common people who just lived closer to reality every day. How did this affect our society, I guess I'm asking, in such a massive general way outside of the halls of academe and philosophers and the other people you speak of in here, like Woodrow Wilson or Margaret Sanger? You have some very interesting things to say about them.
Well, Chesterton lived just at the time when popular culture was coming into its own. When we think about trying to discern the dates of things, one of the things that is an interesting question is, when does popular culture originate? Popular culture is a kind of intellectual complex that destroys folk culture and drives high culture into museums. And it is television, and, you know, it starts with the movies and with the radio, and one of its characteristics is that it is made for sale. It's basically a commercial operation. And it is, if Chesterton were alive today, and I'm sure by the time he died, in what was it, 1938, he would have understood that the common folks that he so admired were being seduced and in a way destroyed by this thing called popular culture. There was there's something about urban life that does this. There was an essay in some journal in the last couple of weeks that contrasted a little town 2 hours south of Kansas City and Kansas City, and it pointed out that 2 hours south of Kansas City, you still didn't schedule things on Wednesday night because that was when the Baptists had prayer meeting. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not characteristic anymore, but that's the shadow of a culture that, you know, I can remember from the rural South in the 1940s and early 50s, but that's all been done in by this virtual television culture that if Chesterton were around now, I don't think he'd be as hopeful about common people. Oh, it's amazing, you know, that the elites are so much easier, seems like, so much easier to seduce. And the more you go to a large, prestigious university, the more seducible you are.
And the more elites talk down to the common person and I guess bully them, really.
Exactly. As you said, it's such a difficult question because you don't want to you want to welcome the life of the mind, you know, but what do you do when the life of the mind is, but you have to be so discerning because so much of the life of the mind is so corrupt that you just don't want your children or young people that you have regard for to have a lot to do with it. And of course, one of the answer is not to build a little Catholic college with drawbridges and keep people shut up so they only think right thought. But you got to think of some way to bring young people into the real, exciting, beautiful, generous sources of Western civilization, which is the kind of foundation of, or which leads to, or which is reflexive of Catholic civilization in the long run.
So in what way then do we not, so the Benedictine monks, of course, who did exactly that, that is, they didn't go into bunkers necessarily, but they retreated to places that were somewhat well guarded, at least until the Vikings got a hold of them several centuries later. And they preserved civilization, but at the same time, they were hospitable towards the outside world, and they led in the evangelization of Northern Europe. And I know, was it Alistair McIntyre who talked about the Benedictine option? And I think somewhere in your essay, I thought you mentioned Toynbee's, the historian Toynbee's phrase of the creative minorities. And there's lots of ways to think about this. And we've had discussions about this on the program before, that a retreat is not an option. But so what is the option then? I mean, I have one child, and I don't want to just throw her out in the culture of death. And sometimes the drawbridge sounds like a pretty good idea. If on this side of the drawbridge we have a discursive Catholic culture, so what answer would you give?
The drawbridge is a real temptation. What I said in the essay was, if what you had to do was sponsor centers of piety and culture in which something can be preserved, and they have to be places that preserve things that are precious. At the same time, they have to have pathways into the larger culture. Because you're not really trying to create a kind of a completely enclosed situation. We haven't done very, very well at this. And my best thought about it is that it's kind of an intellectual failure, because it's not true that if you reduce the life of the mind to the catechism, you've done a very wonderful thing, because you've done a kind of theistic thing that is going to keep that child or that person from engaging the creation that is really not made by the devil, it's made by God, you know. So how you do that is just a really difficult question. The answer that I gave for many years at the College of St. Thomas More was, you create a place in which the conversation is something that inspires a desire for truth and goodness. Because that's the way people learn. People don't learn usually from just propositions. They learn from being part of a community that has certain aspirations and values and knows certain truths. And being part of a community like that, which is, by the way, a free community, it's not a community that has coercion in it, is a converting experience, and that's what Catholic education ought to be. So much of education in the Catholic Church has been run by people who don't like the Church, and which is a great pity. You know, you shouldn't have things that are attempting to do something really attempting.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, I teach at Aquinas College here in Grand Rapids, and this is a college that's in the process of renewal, and it's tough, but it's very hopeful. We've had some very, very good things happen the last 10 to 20 years, much of it propelled by the student body, the John Paul generation, who simply wanted more on the one hand, and I would say they're just generally a pious bunch, and they hunger for transcendence and beauty because they can't find it anywhere, or at least in very few places. So they start hungering for it at the college, in the classroom.
That would be a wonderful topic for another program, somebody else, because one of the things, you know, every time I think about trying to create a Catholic college or university, I think about Notre Dame. Now, Notre Dame is a huge university. It's got, I don't know if it has a Department of Nuclear Physics. Maybe it has. If you've got a Department of Nuclear Physics, you're not going to have eight people who are going to take the Ex Corde Promise. You're not going to get together a bunch of Catholics like that, which means that you need a smaller place, for starters, and you need to confine it to things that we can do, like the liberal arts. But even in a place like Notre Dame, and the way I thought of it, the Notre Dame student body has a significant group of good Catholics mm-hmm. who represent the faith in a kind of happy and effective way, you know, proving that Christ in the heart, the Catholic Church of the heart, is really hard to kill. So it's not going to go away. But that again brings up the question: who encourages? You know, a lot of things that happen in Catholic education are, you wonder, because all of these Catholic schools are owned by somebody, and all of them exist with the toleration of ecclesiastical authority. You just kind of wonder what kind of attention is paid to them in a certain sense. But enough of that. What else can I say about this that might be helpful to any living human soul?
We have about 5-6 minutes left on the program, and one of the things I'd like to talk about in our closing minutes here is that one of your other solutions, that is, you say, look, we've got these barbarian incursions that have changed the way we live in the West, in the lands formerly known as Christendom, and we don't want to pull up our drawbridge. We don't want to only hang out among our own, because the gospel encourages us to go out and convert the world. So we've talked about a few solutions here. Getting out of town intellectually and imaginally is one of the things you mentioned. But you also just say, go ahead and have a family. Go ahead and have a family, which is the fundamental community of human existence. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, you know, and I think about the fact that the devil has made that a principal focus of his attack. You know, convince men that they don't want to be fathers, they don't want to be responsible. Convince women they don't want to be mothers. Destroy the family, and then what have you got but a state that is owned and operated by the other side? You know, so...
Tocqueville saw this all quite clearly, but, you know, 150 years ago, didn't he? That is, you break away every association between the individual or the family and the state, and there's nothing left. It's just you and the state, right? And the state moves in, and the state has a different end, as Augustine says, in the City of God, to get back to Augustine, than the church does, or than we do as human beings. That the state's end is not to... is to hopefully keep peace if it's doing the right thing, but quite often it's doing the wrong thing. But keeping the peace is not the same as bringing us to God and to know and love and serve God.
Exactly. Well, you know, I made myself unpopular all over many places, because I just think I agree with Malcolm Muggeridge that one of the most heroic things that the church has ever done was Humanae Vitae. And I don't care if only 10% of the Catholic population pays attention to it or whatever it is. That's the heart of the difficulty, is that the purpose of marriage is the family. And when you move away from that, you move into chaos, and that's kind of what we've got. I didn't discuss that in the essay, but that, of course, was the whole point of Margaret Sanger and all of that wretched business that she wanted, was to reduce us to the situation in which the only purpose of marriage is a kind of pleasure, and you see that, as you know, around you now, that pleasure is the deal. Let me say before we go, do you have another question?
No, please. What would you like to say?
I just want to say that if anybody is interested, you can get to the Walsingham Society with any adept user of the Internet can do www.walsinghamsociety, and you'll come up with something, and we'd be happy to hear from you, to send you the stuff that we publish if you had any interest in it.
So is this essay we've been discussing, is that published or available online somewhere?
It's in a publication called Ideas and Images, but you know, we could probably post it online, because we're interested in disseminating things just as widely as we can. I will ask the people who are responsible for that just to post it.
Okay, yeah, that would be great. And that's at walsinghamsociety.com, I think. I have it up here on my computer right now, and it looks at walsinghamsociety.com. And I see you also offer retreats. You have your School of Liberal Studies. Your emphasis is on the great books. It's been interesting to me, Dr. Patrick, over the course of the last hour here on Faith and Reason, that we kept coming back to education, and maybe it's because you've been president of a college and I'm a college professor and we just can't help it, but I don't think that's the reason. I think that education is so tied to what the human person is, as somebody drawn to the truth and who wants to know. And when we squash that by saying, well, you can't know anything, and what you can know doesn't really matter, and that whatever people knew in the past isn't important, so just make your own future, follow your bliss, as a few people I know would say, who are older than I am by a generation. Then we have the society we have that might look like it's doing well to some people, but to me, it strikes me very much like the kind that could crumble like a cream puff. And so hopefully Catholics will be ready for that, because I imagine any kind of you probably can't imagine the end of Texas, but maybe the end of the United States of America. That would be quite shocking, I think.
Well, it would be quite shocking, but every empire comes to an end, and we're not, as St. Augustine said, I hope it's not yet.
Yeah, yes, not yet, and there's good things, at least in my understanding of Catholic teaching on the polity, is that the state is not a necessary evil. It can actually accomplish some good things if it does what it's supposed to. It's a bit like academic freedom. You can have it if you're only paying attention to what your job is meant to be. You know, once you start going off the rails, well, then you're only causing trouble.
That's exactly right. I mean, the Catholic Church doesn't have a Manichaean doctrine of the state that it can only do evil. Although, you know, in our Constitution, written in the 18th century, one of the things they really tried to do, one of the things they had a firm grasp of was a kind of secular notion of original sin,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that that power would get out of control. So they tried to limit that, but that's a whole other topic.
I use a guide written by Wilfred McClay in my U.S. history classes, and he has a line in there. It's a student's guide to U.S. history published by ISI. And it says you don't have to believe in original sin to be a good history student, but it really helps. Because ultimately my students will ask questions like, well, why did that person do this? Or why did they do that? Or, well, this seems really odd. Why did this occur? What do you think was behind Andrew Jackson's Indian removal? That's all the kinds of questions. And, you know, ultimately sometimes we really do in the classroom, thankfully, because I'm at a Catholic college, we'll just sort of break it down to selfishness and sin or greed, the love of money. And things are not always rational. Well, this is Dr. John Pinero. For the last hour, you've been listening to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo. We've been talking with Dr. James Patrick, a senior fellow with the Walsingham Society of Christian Culture and Western Civilization, about the barbarians, ancient and modern, and what a good Catholic ought to be doing about that. Dr. Patrick, I want to thank you very much for coming on the program. I found your essay quite inspirational, really, and I'm glad that it ended on a positive note of hope, as any Christian essay ought to.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. John. I enjoyed talking with you.
Okay, thank you. Have a good afternoon. And thank you very much for listening to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. We have our encore programs on Saturday. You can check on our website to see archived shows, upcoming shows. And please, if you're not already following us on Facebook for updates and such, you can you ought to get on Facebook and follow Faith and Reason there. Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinero is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.